A masterful debut novel derives lessons of love from history. And W.E.B. Du Bois.
You see a lot of anger in the book. More than that, you see rage sometimes. But I want people to also see tenderness. And I want people to understand that, like Du Bois, and we are all his children, those of us who do this sort of work, he had a profound love for humanity. You can't do this kind of work if all that motivates you is rage. There has to be a moment where you are trying to show people, you're trying to lift up a lantern and show them a better path. And that always, at the top of everything, is not anger. It's not rage. It's love.
That's Honoré Fanon-Jeffers, award-winning poet and now novelist. We talk with her about the love songs of W.E.B. Du Bois, just out from HarperCollins. Then, two young black women build a literary business around poetry and life lessons. We talk with Jade D. and Wilnona Marie, the And I Thought ladies. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. Honoré Fanon-Jeffers' debut novel, The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois, is already racking up the kudos, and it's only been out since August 24th. Oprah picked it for her book club. The New York Times reviewer called it, quote, quite simply the best book that she had read in a very, very long time, and it's up for numerous awards. I'm in the fan club. I read every word of this nearly 800-word masterpiece, including the prologue and acknowledgments, in 2 day-long sittings, and I was utterly rapt. So what's it about? I'll let the great writer Jacqueline Woodson, a former Writer's Voice guest, describe it. She writes, "This sweeping, brilliant, and beautiful narrative is at once a love song to black girlhood, family, history, joy, pain, and so much more. In Jeffers' deft hands, the story of race and love in America becomes the great American novel." The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois is about a family through the centuries, and also about one young descendant living in the contemporary world who discovers her family's story. The author of 5 acclaimed books of poetry, Honoré Fanon-Jeffers brings her poetic lyricism to her prose in this, her debut novel. Jeffers is professor of English at the University of Oklahoma in Norman. Honoré Fanon-Jeffers, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much.
Before we get into this wonderful, wonderful novel, The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois, I want to ask you, because you have written 5 books before. They've all been poetry, 5 poetry volumes. One was longlisted for the 2020 National Book Award. Congratulations on that.
Thank you so much.
Now, is this your first novel?
Yes, this is my first novel. I've written published several Chiquita short stories. So I've been in this universe of the novel for a long time, but this is my first novel. Hopefully, though, not my last.
Yeah, right. Hopefully, I agree with that. So it is a magnificent family saga and so much more. It's history, it's poetry, it's legend. Running to well over 700 pages, it was a compulsive read. It has many characters and plot twists. It's clearly a labor of love. So I'm curious about what it took to make the transition from poetry to fiction.
Well, you know, poetry is like breathing to me. You know, it's not something, the first draft is effortless. The craft that you impose on the poetry when you come back to it, I always tell my students, the first draft is for you. And the subsequent drafts are for your audience. So when you come back to poetry, that's when, you know, the labor, the, you know, the headache, the heartache, sometimes you have to give up your best lines. All of that comes later. But in the first draft, it's ecstatic. Many times I write a first draft of a poem all at once. Fiction is something that you have to fight for. You are not going to be able to write an 800-page novel. This is an 800-page novel in 2 or 3 months. You know, you're not going to be able to do that. So one of the things that I had a particular way of a particular discipline with my poetry, and I had to reimagine that for fiction. I don't write poetry every day. Usually I'll binge write 2 to 3 poems at once, and then maybe a couple weeks later or 3 weeks later, a month later, I'll write some more poems. Fiction, you gotta get up or stay up, you know, whether you're a morning person, whether you're a midnight creeper, right? You got to get up and you have to get in your words every day. And sometimes it feels really, really good. And sometimes it's boring and you don't want to do it, but you just have to stay with it.
Well, you certainly stayed with it. Also, just the many layered richness of this novel. It moves back and forth between 2 plot lines. One is historical and the other is roughly contemporary, although they are connected to each other. And it has so many layers to it. You start out the book with a personal note, though. You learned about slavery, you say, by eavesdropping on conversations from all the Black folks in your family. So tell us about your family, because I have a feeling your family is an important underpinning to how you did this novel.
Well, my mother's people are from Eatonton, Georgia, and Milledgeville, Georgia. Eatonton is a real small little town, and they look at Milledgeville as the city. That's how small, and Milledgeville is small. So Eatonton, when I was going down there for my summers, there were only about 3,000 people in Eatonton. It is very, it's still very de facto segregated. The downtown area at least is not like that anymore. But when I was growing up in the 70s and the 80s, there was a white pool and then there was a Black pool. There were still stores where Black people had to walk in the back of the store, even in the early 80s. So it's a very dusty little town. And when I was also growing up, you know, I'm an older person, there wasn't cable TV. So you only had like 2 channels. And one was PBS and one, I think, was CBS or something like that. So you spend a lot of time just talking to one another. And I was a sedentary child, so I didn't play a lot with the other children, although, you know, my grandmother made my cousins and the other kids who would come around in the neighborhood, she made them play with me, even though I was very socially awkward. But I like to sit up underneath the old people, and I knew how to remain silent and how not to move. And they would forget I was there. And that's how you found out secrets in the family. But also, my grandmother was born in 1909. So she was only two generations away from slavery. Her father's mother, great-grandma Mandy, was born in slavery. And great-grandma Mandy, one of her first memories was that her father was sold down the river to Mississippi or Louisiana. So this was a real trauma that had impacted her.
So Chickasetta, which is the small town in which this is placed, is a fictional town. Is that right?
Yes, it's fictional, but Putnam County is an actual county in Georgia. And Alice Walker is from Eatonton, Putnam County. My mother taught Alice Walker in junior high school. The man that transcribed the traditional Brer Rabbit, we don't say burr in the black community. It's always was so funny to me growing up when people would say Brer Rabbit because it's Brer Rabbit. It's a contraction of brother. Joel Chandler Harris is from Eatonton. There's actually an Uncle Remus Museum. Rather racist, but there's an Uncle Remus Museum in Eatonton. And so yes, it's a fictitious town, but it was a town that I started envisioning when I was in my 20s. I missed Eatonton. And so I think that because I was in graduate school, I didn't spend a lot of time there anymore. I sort of had outgrown parts of Eatonton. Some of my childhood friends had gone to prison, different things like that. So I think I created Chickasetta in my imagination so that I could still be in Eatonton. But I knew that, you know, it wouldn't be fair to be telling people's real life stories without their permission. So then I just began, you know, making up events. Then I started making up genealogy. I started thinking about what would the downtown, the little small town look like. Fortunately, in most deep southern, you know, rural towns, the downtown is on a square. They all look the same. So I just began populating this town. And that's how I started a writing about Chickasetta.
So this is the love songs of W.E.B. Du Bois. And throughout the novel, you have wonderful quotes from Du Bois's work. Why Du Bois? How is he in some way the lodestone of this novel, The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois? Honoré Fanon Jeffers.
Well, I was introduced to Du Bois's work when I was in junior high school. And when I went to college, early and then finished late. So took me 6 years to get through college. But when I went to college, I was 16. And I went to first one historically Black college, Clark College, in Atlanta, Georgia, which is now Clark Atlanta University. And we read Du Bois in literature classes. We read Du Bois in history classes. We read Du Bois in political science classes. And then when I transferred to another historically Black college, I noticed the same. He was the center of Black intellectual life. And anybody Black who was considered educated had to have read at least one or two of Du Bois's work. He first went down south to Fisk University in 1885, and he graduated in 1888. And when he was at Fisk University, which is also a historically Black institution, he fell in love with Southern Black people. And this fascination with Black folks, the devotion and the duty to us, was a lifelong charge. And in the same way, the protagonist of the novel, Ailie Pearl Garfield, has this same lifelong charge. She's introduced to Du Bois as a teenager, as I was. But the first time she's introduced is by hearing a relative of hers, Uncle Root, tell her about meeting who he called the great scholar. And then that same summer, Uncle Root gives her an edition of The Souls of Black Folk. And so Du Bois becomes a shadow character all through the book. And his writing guides us through the story of Ailie's family. But what also guides us, and the reason that the title of the novel is what it is, he loved Black people. He loved Southern Black people, like Ailie's family. And so these songs are his songs.
Yes. And, you know, I really felt that love infused every page of this book as well. I mean, in the sense I could sense your love.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, of the culture. And in fact, on page 153, you write in the voice of Ailie when she's talking about her people and where she comes from. And she quotes her mother, "To find this kind of love, you have to enter deep country." What is that deep country? Give us a flavor of it.
Well, deep country in the South is a place where there's a tug of war between progress and the past. Sometimes not in a good way. Sometimes you still have white supremacy. You still have a lot of people whose ancestors were members of the Ku Klux Klan or the White Citizens Council, and now they have power in the town. But it's also a place of deep joy where Black folks have maintained cultural aspects, food ways, storytelling, approaches to spirituality. And it's a place where I felt the most loved. I felt happy when I would go to these places. And you felt like when you were sitting underneath one of these old Black oaks and they were taking the time to tell you something, you felt special, like you were the only person in the world. You know, I tell my students, get to know the old people in your family because they have a story they want to tell before they leave the earth. And they want to tell it to somebody who's going to tend to the story. And that's what being in deep country means. It means that you have to respect, you know, even if you sort of chafe against old-fashioned ways, right? You don't call old Black people in the South by their first name. You put a Mr. or you put a Miss, even if you only know their first name. You say Mr. John, you know, Miss Gwendolyn. Even if you chafe against the old-fashioned ways, you understand that this is what has allowed our people to survive so much horror, is that we tend to our history and we tend to our culture, not in academic ways, but in everyday ways.
You also say that The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois is a Black feminist novel.
And yes,
the women are central and powerful in this book, just amazing characters. Talk about that. A Black feminist novel, also the women, you know, central to the survival of Black people in this country?
Well, I was thinking about this because a few months ago, when I was talking about my book of poetry that came out last year, someone asked me to speak on Stacey Abrams and how Stacey Abrams is extraordinary, but she is part of a group of Black women going all the way back, right? It's not just Stacey. Stacey is part of a Black women's movement. And one of the things about the women in this book, only Ailey would call herself a feminist. The other women, even though they're very strong, they don't have necessarily a political affiliation, but they are very much empowered. You see this with Bail as a young woman, a young married woman with a small child. You see this with her mother, Miss Rose. Even the fact that Miss Rose's mother, Pearl, named her child First Person Miss, right? First name Miss, middle name Rose, okay? Because Black women were never respected with honorifics during a particular time in the South. You weren't called Miss or Mrs. They might call you Auntie or something like that, which was very much a derisive term, but that's as respectful as it would get. So she names her child Miss so that people will have to call her an honorific if they call her name. So you have these sort of, again, deep country, everyday feminist gestures, not necessarily marching in the street or, you know, those sort of things, but everyday strengths that these women have in order to survive. And so when Ailey begins, you know, this is her coming of age in part, when she begins to get older, she has to wrestle with, what are the real life implications of being a feminist? You can call yourself a feminist, but if you're going to stay in situations that are going to strip you of your agency, can you truly call yourself a feminist? Like, there's a scene at one point where her mother, Bail, says, you know, she sees Ailey fixing a plate for her boyfriend, and she says, I thought you were a feminist, right? So there are these sort of tugs of war. One of the things that I'm also curious about is the fact that Black women during the 17th century were forced to be heads of family by that partis sequitur ventrum law, which changed English common law. What it did is, before then, the father determined whether a child was free or enslaved. But after 1662, then the mother's status determined it. And so that was, I think, a very real moment where Black women were in a position white women, European women, were not in, and they had to improvise.
And why within the structure of slavery was that done?
Well, the real reason was that several years before, a biracial Black woman named Elizabeth Key had been, her father was English and her mother was African. This was in the 17th century. And her father put her in an indenture. And so she was an indentured servant. And her indenture lasted longer than it should have. The people who owned her indenture just pretended like they could just keep her. And so when the person that owned her indenture died, their descendants then claimed Elizabeth Key as a lifelong slave. Elizabeth Key was in a relationship with a former indentured servant who was an Englishman. His last name was Grinstead, and he studied the law. So he went to court and sued so that, you know, this woman who was the mother of two of his children, she could be free and their children could be free. She won, but several years later, that's when they decided to change the law to say that it didn't matter if you were baptized, because that was one of the justifications that Elizabeth Key had used. She said she had been baptized as a Christian, so then she should be free. So they changed the law to say it didn't matter if you were Black, if you were baptized, that did not guarantee you freedom. And it didn't matter if your father was free, if your mother was enslaved.
Wow, that is so interesting. Honoré Ray Fanon Jeffers, I mean, this is just an example of the kind of history that, you know, we read in the book, but it's just woven into the story. I mean, there's just layers and layers upon of this history. Another thread that you follow is Afro-Indigenous history. So talk a little bit about that within the context of the love songs of W.E.B. Du Bois, your novel.
Well, Central Georgia is known as a Black Indian enclave. There are a lot of Black folks. For example, there's the last name Driscoll, which is actually a Cherokee last name. When I came out here, I found all of, out here to Oklahoma, I found all of these Native American folks with the last name Driscoll. It's a well-known Native American name. But in Georgia, most of the Driscolls that I met were Black. So one of the things about being Afro-Indigenous is that you can't prove that you have Indigenous blood if your people were not removed. You're not on any kind of roll. And so I was curious about this. I've been curious about this for a very long time because my family on both sides, my mother and my father's side, have always claimed Native American blood. And it was very distressing to me that because these records were not kept, I would never know. And so I began to think about how might a family like mine have come into being, have come into existence. And I knew I would never know. So I began to read the history and I began to find out that my family was not uncommon, that there were many Black people. There were Cherokee slaveholders. There were Creek slaveholders. But one of the reasons that I incorporated an Indigenous storyline into the book is that when I knew that I wanted to go back before slavery was legal in Georgia, back before Georgia was even called Georgia, I knew I was going to have to reckon with Indigenous history. That was very frightening to me, because I am not an enrolled member of a Native American tribe, and, you know, and I didn't want to be disrespectful, but I knew that it was going to be disrespectful if I erased an essential part of Georgia history. So when you look at the sort of 30 or 40 pages that I have on Afro-Indigenous history, that took me about 6 or 7 years of research, just those 30 or 40 pages. But I also, one of the things that I found really interesting and knew that it was going to be an Afro-Indigenous story that I, you know, I at first I was sort of playing around with it and then something just clicked, was when you began to look at the history, I began to see intersections between Indigenous history and Black history. For example, there were something called the slave codes in 18th century Georgia, which policed the movements of Black people, when they could gather, whether they could own firearms, whether, you know, all of these sort of things. And what I noticed is that in these slave codes, Native Americans are mentioned. And that blew my mind. So it meant that for several decades, even when Native Americans were free, they occupy this sort of hazy status as both free and unfree. Then, you know, there's the Federal Road that went through Creek and Cherokee lands in Georgia that was forced through. This was originally the idea of Thomas Jefferson. And then I found out that after the transatlantic slave trade was outlawed and slavery then became an internal trade in the United States, that the Federal Road was used to transport enslaved Black folks. So there are all these sort of intersections, right? Who's free, who isn't free? Who's white, who isn't white? And I began to think about what would happen, Francesca, when the laws would be imposed upon a family, a multiracial family. How would they respond? You know, what would family begin to mean if part of your family was considered free and the other part wasn't? What would it mean for one person in your family to own another person in your family? What would ensue? And so that's how, you know, it's a very tangled story, because American history, Georgian history, is very tangled.
And I wanted to ask you about that. I'm glad you've said this, because there is a lot in the book that really explores in depth all these different kinds of threads, tangled threads. And one of them is the rape that underlies so much of, you know, the multiracial nature of families. You get at it with the rape of children, child sexual abuse, you know, the making of a monster, the Samuel Pinchard, who is the master. He himself is a sexual abuse advisor, and then he's in a position of power and becomes a monster. So why this angle in the book? Talk about that.
Well, I think that a lot of this history is hidden in plain sight. For example, when we talk about Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, we talk about Sally Hemings as a young woman, but Sally Hemings was 14 years old when Thomas Jefferson began assaulting her. People want to look at it as a love story, but if you have no choice in the matter, is it truly love? You know, that's something else that, you know, I wanted to explore. You know, what is love? What is assault? You know, what happens when these things happen in families? When we look, another book that I mention in the archival coda, Harriet Jacobs' Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, when she talks about, you know, being sexually harassed by one master and then getting involved with another white man to try to protect her from this man who owns her. And I kept hearing her called a young woman, but again, she was 12 or 13 years old. So one of the things that I wanted to talk about was the adultification of Black children when we talk about abuse. We call little girls young women. We call little boys young men, right? Or we look at their bodies and we decide, right, this is not a child. You know, we have seen Black children killed in contemporary times. And, you know, and the police officers justify their body was so big, or they, I thought I was looking at a grown man. And so one of the things that I wanted to explore is that Black children were not allowed their childhood under slavery when they should have, and that we need to stop justifying, you know, these sort of things by adultifying them. The other thing is the age of quote unquote consent for young white girls in Georgia in the 18th and 19th century, up until, you know, the 20th century, until they changed the law, was 10 years old, Francesca.
Whoa.
Yes. For free white girls was 10 years old. So then you begin to understand, right? Although my story is about Black women, then you begin to understand what was going on with white women, white females, white female children. So that was one of the things that I really wanted to explore, because I began to think about if you had someone like Samuel Pinchard, and, you know, I don't want to upset people, but I also want people to understand why Black folks get so mad, okay? when they say, you know, oh, this is in the past. When you begin to understand there was a thriving trade in little girls, in 11-year-olds, 12-year-olds, when you begin to understand the average age of menarche was 14, 15, 16 years old. Okay. So these were flat chested, narrow hipped children. So there was a thriving trade, particularly in New Orleans, for mixed race little girls. So I began probably maybe 3 years into the novel. I began to think about what if there were predators during slavery, which we have predators now, so we can assume there were predators then. They would be like a kid in a candy store if they had complete control. And that's when I began to think about Samuel Pinchard. But let me say, it was very painful writing him. And it was never my intention to write just those few pages of his song. I didn't want to write that. But my editor said to me, you have to show how he came about, you know, because I think that people really, when they think about things like evil, they just think, oh, people are born this way. And that's a cop out. That means that it's easy for people to sort of justify, right? That if evil just comes about organically, if someone is just born flawed, then no one has to take responsibility for how we arrive at particular moments. And so I had to write his story. And I was concerned because I didn't want people to think that I was trying to justify, you know, who he was. But at the same time, everyone was a child once. Even he was a child once. Even he deserved to be safe from violence. And that is something, you know, you really get into human nature when you write a book like this. It's a lot. It's a lot.
And finally, just really kind of coming off of that point, there is a profound humanism in this book, and also a profound humanism in W.E.B. Du Bois's work. You have yes. one quote from him that I just have to read and ask you why you included it and what it means to you. It's from Evolution of the Negro. And Du Bois says, "Self-realization is thus coming slowly but surely to another of the world's great races, the black race, and they are today girding themselves to fight in the van of progress, not simply for their own right as men, but for the ideals of the greater world in which they live, the emancipation of women, universal peace, democratic government, the socialization of wealth, and human brotherhood." And I would just like to end there because that is such a clarion call for love on the broadest scale. So talk a little bit about why you included that.
Well, I think that a lot of times, you know, I'd like to say I'm not alone in writing about these issues. There are many of us. And all of us are not black who are writing about these issues. All of us are not novelists or poets. Some of us are historians, you know, some of us are educators. But you see a lot of anger in the book. More than that, you see rage sometimes. But I want people to also see tenderness. And I want people to understand that, like Du Bois, and we are all, you know, his children, you know, those of us who do this sort of work. He had a profound love for humanity. You can't do this kind of work if all that motivates you is rage. There has to be a moment where you are trying to show people, you're trying to lift up a lantern and show them a better path. And that always, at the top of everything, is not anger, it's not rage, it's love. It's love for my people, love and pride that we have gone through this and we continue to go, but it's also love for greater humanity because we're all joined. If we fail, everyone fails. It's not like, oh, one particular community can just be wiped out and that's going to be fine. If one community fails, the entire human experiment fails. And that's what I really wanted to, you know, that's why the book is so long, you know, but that, you know, I wanted to show people that Dr. Du Bois had this tenderness and he has gifted this to us. He has left an inheritance of tenderness with us.
Right. And I think we've gotten a big lesson in that with the pandemic in this last year as well.
Yes. Yes, we have.
Well, Honoré Fanon Jeffers, Dr. Jeffers, are you a doctor?
I'm a professor. My mother is doctor. And she will never let you forget that either.
That's great. Well, Honoré Fanon Jeffers, thank you so much for talking with us here. This book is a compulsive read. It is an important book, and I feel so honored to be able to talk with you about it. The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois.
Thank you. The honor was all mine.
Honoré Fanon Jeffers. Go to writersvoice.net to read a sample from The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois. Next up, we talk with two young black women who use poetry to teach life lessons. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I met our next guests when they invited me onto their podcast, The And I Thought Ladies. I had no idea what to expect, after just a few minutes Googling their work, which includes a series of poetry books, self-described as literary life guides with pop poetry. It's called the And I Thought series. They also publish The Misfit Guide. In addition to the podcast and books, J.D. and Wilnona Marie, the And I Thought ladies, also have two magazines, a store, a literary festival, and more. They are a dual powerhouse. And as I found when first they interviewed me for their podcast, and then I interviewed them for Writer's Voice, they're two very thoughtful and energetic women who seek to make a difference in people's lives with poetry. For this broadcast, we only have time for a short segment from the full interview, but that interview in full will be on our website, writersvoice.net. Wilnona Marie and J.D., welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having us. This is Jade, by the way. Thank you for having us on. Really appreciate it.
This is Wilnona.
Well, hi to you both. You are the And I Thought ladies. Now, tell us about these books. How many do you have? Now, you publish them, you self-publish them on Amazon. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, we do self-publish them because, as people would say, poets don't make money. So no one's really willing to take a chance on it, which is fine because, you know, we write literary life guides.
This is Wilnona, and I'm going to say the way we write our books are very odd. And even when we tell publishers, like, because, you know, now we've been around a minute, we meet actual publishers, and we're like, oh, yeah, we write poetry. And they go, oh, I'm sorry. And you're like, no, we do actually make money writing poetry. And they go, well, what's different about your book? And then we explain how we set up our book, and they're like, we're glad you self-published that because there's no way anyone else would let you do that. So, yeah, I think it was the best bet for self-publishing. Although I did sign a 3-book contract with a publisher for my genre writing.
Okay, well, I'll get to that in a minute. But so explain these books. Pop poetry, what do you mean by that? And in what way are they literary life guides?
This is Jade, and I will take the pop poetry. So I compare it all to music. So, you know, the Billie Holidays and the Aretha Franklin and the B.B. Kings of the world, we are definitely not them. We are more like the Britney Spears or the Ariana Grandes of the world when we write poetry. Because a lot of times poetry doesn't tell you exactly what they mean. They kind of, you're still scratching your head 5 years later. Like, I think this is what the poem means. No, we tell you exactly what we mean.
This is Wilnona. And for the second part, well, I'm going to say one more thing on Jade's section. So when we say we tell you exactly what we mean by our poetry, we literally have a sentence that we call the clarification sentence. Just in case you thought we meant something else, there's a sentence normally at the end of our poems that says, this is what we meant. It doesn't say this is what we meant. It explains explicitly what we meant. So we want people to be able to read the poetry, enjoy the poetry. And that's been like years analyzing it and pulling it apart and meaning, what did you mean by imagery? And this, they can if they want to. Feel free. Do it. I think it's wonderful. But for people who are just want to read poetry and understand it, this is the kind of read that we are, hence why we're pop poets. To answer the second half of your question as to literary life guides, it's because we wrote with people who started from the age of 25 to the age of 75 at that time. And we figured this is the only way that a 25-year-old was probably going to pay attention to a 75-year-old, a 40-year-old, a 34-year-old, a 55-year-old. And the only way that, like, the 75-year-old was going to come in contact with the 25-year-old wisdom. So we feel that these books pick up where life kind of left off for a woman, because there's so much out there that a woman needs to know, or a man, that people need to know. And you just didn't catch it in your college course. Hence one of our books being called And I Thought Being Grown Up Was Easy. Now, we do have something called Life Lessons in them in the first book. So that it has a little quote and it's the beginning of every chapter. Instead of us having chapter titles, we have a quote and a life lesson. And then the poems and the short stories and the flash fictions apply to that. For And I Thought Being Grown Up Was Easy, it's a recipe for And I Thought Divorce, And I Thought I Did My Journey Alone. It's actually a story of a journey of an adventurer going to find themselves. So instead of having a chapter, you have the traveler did this, the traveler did that, and then the poems address what the traveler did in those poems.
Now, a lot of what you deal with in these books are issues of abuse. In fact, well, Nona Marie, you got an award for abuse survival advocacy and book. Is that right?
Yes, I got an award for addressing being an abuse survivor as an advocate and my book series. Like, so I wrote a lot of poetry about what I did to kind of emotionally heal, to take the next steps. And I'm not going to say that I am an expert at it because I don't feel like that every day. There's still days I struggle really hard, but I did survive and I'm starting to learn how to thrive. So I figured, you know, it's a good idea to share that with other people because it's not just me who's gone through an emotional abusive relationship.
Yes. And I was interested about what you say about calling out emotional abuse, because it's something, you know, people know about physical abuse and they know about sexual abuse, but emotional abuse is not spoken about all that much and it can be just as devastating. So talk a little bit about what emotional abuse means to you and how you address it in your work.
So how I addressed it in my work, I really liked helping Alexis with writing a shiner. And I did not have my name on that poem at all because I do not want to take credit for that poem, but we did confer and work on it together. But a shiner is a lot about how society thinks, okay, so you got divorced and you said you're in an abusive relationship, but he didn't hit you. So why can't you just go back to acting the way that you used to act? Not recognizing that your brain is just injured. And it did not, I think my favorite line is that in that whole poem was like, my bones were not set, so they did not heal correctly. Like if I had been physically abused, then I would have had a cast on and my bones would have had time to rest and build, remold themselves. But with an emotional abuse, no one sees that. You don't go to the hospital for that and be like, you know, I need to reset my emotions. No, you don't. So society doesn't really see that as abuse as much. You don't see it. You don't see it on the outside. So they're like, go back to who you were. Act like you used to act. I mean, why are you making this decision? Why are you afraid of these words? It's because I have not recovered from this injury. You just like, boom, you had emotional abuse, boom, get back to life. And you can't. And you just can't.
You know, and we should say, you do have some other women who are working with you on these poems. And you just mentioned one, Alexis. You know, emotional abuse, is it something like, you know, emotional abuse can really change you from within so that you even doubt who you are? I mean, is that some of why it can be so difficult to heal from it? Because the changes are very much the way you think about yourself.
It's true. It is very much so the way you think about yourself. By the way, this is still Will Nona. And I'm surprised Jade is sitting over here like, no, keep going, keep going. I'm like, you want to say anything? She's like, no, keep going. Okay. But we did work with one. We still do work with one of the charities and the EU in the UK. And one of those presidents, Marilyn Hawes, she said that when you experience abuse before, like you're 25 years old, that it literally remodels your mind. So it can remodel your mind so that you might have thought a certain way beforehand, but after the abuser, it has remodeled your mind to have a different thought pattern. And I had never heard that explained in the physiological realm of understanding why you still think in the way that the abuser had you think. But for an emotional and thought pattern sort of way, when someone is constantly telling you things like, you know, if you weren't born, my life would be better because you're just that way, you're just like a waste of living air. Like, why do you breathe? And they tell you that every day. All day, eventually you're asking yourself the same question. Why am I here? Why am I breathing? Why am I taking up the space? So that in itself, when you leave it, the thought is still there. The action attached to that thought is still there. And you're still going to go through those everyday actions, even without the person telling you. It's connected to the actions and the way that you believe and see yourself.
So this is Jade, and another way to say that, it's literally the if-then statement.
Say more.
You are breathing. Why? So it's you're alive, so then you're wasting space. I'm just an observer, so I can't fully speak to the full experience, but I've seen what it does to my best friend's life and then other people of my acquaintance and other friends. And I started to recognize that it's the abuser and how they get into your reasoning, right? So you're trying to reason it out, like, you know, you're trying to be logical. I don't know. Maybe it's just how I observe it, but if you're trying to be logical about it, but you've had someone tell you how to think for a long time.
And how does it feel for you to see the impact on your best friend of abuse of that kind?
It does make you upset that someone thinks that they have the right to do that to another human being. And it makes you sad. But then it makes you go, it made me say to myself, well, I just need to be here. I need to show up every day or whenever. I need to show up and be there for my friends that I know have went through this. I need to be there for them. And even if they want to tell me the same story, like they told me yesterday and they're going to tell me again today. And I'm pretty sure when we talk tomorrow, they're going to tell me the same story, to listen. Like it's the first time that they told you this story because they need to get it out. They need someone there for them. And as a friend, wouldn't I want someone to be there for me to hear the same story if I went through heck and pulled myself out of it?
Right. And what I get also is that you're steadfast, but you guys have also both put this into your work. Have you had feedback from people who have read your books about how it's helped them maybe get out of that cycle of abuse?
No, we haven't had that. This is Jay. We haven't had that, but we've had people that said that they were glad someone talked about it. Right? Because like I recognized it was happening. I left, but to see it written down, to see like there's other people, and basically there's nothing to be ashamed of.
This is Wilnona, and when we do go on tour, we hear some very heartbreaking stories. And then sometimes when we do our poetic readings, that's where you get a lot of people when we read Old College Try. And then they'll talk about how they wish the book was around when they were younger, or they wish the book was around for their mother or for somebody in college, or some people even buy the book just to give to someone. Mm-hmm. And be like, maybe that'll help them see what's going on right now. But it does, I think that's nice to know that we are helping in that manner. Just give it a name, give it a face, and then help you understand that you are not crazy and you're not being gaslighted. I think it's gaslit. Is it gaslit or gaslighted? I think it's gaslit.
Yeah, you point out something that's I think that does make emotional abuse so different, which is that it's often much more difficult to identify that you are being abused, because that's what gaslighting is all about. You question yourself. I mean, if somebody hits you, you know that's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But if somebody is telling you something that you also know isn't true, but gee, are you sure it's not true? Are you the one that's crazy? That's a much more difficult thing to deal with.
Very much so. And that's kind of the thing that really sticks in your mind. So when you think about something, you question yourself. Even when they're gone, you still question yourself. Is this true? Is this an action that they saw that was correct? It's kind of hard.
And that goes along with, you know, how often women are told that what they think and feel is not, you know, is not right, is not true. So you have on your website, you have a podcast called The Women's Cave, as opposed to The Man Cave. Talk a little bit about, you know, some of the feminist, in the best sense of the word, feminist values that inform the work you do.
Okay, this is Jade, and The Women's Cave was born because we were like, why do men get to have their cave? Like, I have a cave for myself, right? It's like full of books and like scotch and bourbon because I like it, and like a pool table because I like pool, you know, like things like that. But also it's a place where like Wilnona and I and our friends, we hang out, we go and we sit down and we hang out and we talk and laugh it up. And so as a podcast, we said, well, why don't we just transfer that on over to our podcast, right? It's a place where our friends, where friends come and meet and learn stuff, right? Because after you talk to your friends for a whole evening, like 4 or 5 hours, you walk away and you learn some stuff, or you found, you had some revelations. Because I know that always happens to me, at least me. Then I don't know, I might be the only one out here that's like, oh yeah, I talked to my friend for 4 hours and I learned some stuff and it was good. Had some aha moments.
This was well known. And on the podcast front, we originally started off as exactly how Jade said, was we had done like 125 interviews. We were sitting there and we were like, well, we should do something afterwards. And so we decided to do a friendly chat afterwards. And that was our original podcast. Now, when we went further on, we were like, you know, I don't think people are going to want to hear us talk forever. And I'm sure we'll run out of things to talk about. So we started interviewing other women that we had met on while we were doing these interviews. Like, so do 125 interviews, you meet people. And then you're like, why don't you come on my show? And they talk to them. And the goal really is to make it a brief show, about 15 to 17 minutes long, so it doesn't take up too much of a listener's time. And to learn at least 3 facts while you're there and have fun. I mean, Francesca, you were on the show. I hope you had fun.
Oh, I had a lot of fun, as a matter of fact. I think it was longer than 15 minutes, but it was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it. So you both, well, Nona Marie and JD, you write about and work with other women writing about something that is common to many, many women. You're both young Black women. Does that also contribute some perspective to your work?
This is Winona, and oh wait, I should probably have Jade answer this question first because she's better at this.
I'm better at this. I don't know if I'm better. This is Jade. It's very interesting, and I like to think of it as when we write with different people, because we write with different ethnicities and everything, but we all have a different view and we bring it to the table, mm-hmm. which is, I feel like that's a lot that's missing, right? People don't value other people's viewpoint. So it's really great to have different age groups, different races, different journeys in life come together and write something, because you learn like one fact that I've learned it many times over the years that we've been doing this, is that we're all humans and we're all in this thing called life. And we kind of all have the same problems if we just stop and listen. And cut out all the noise.
That's beautiful.
So how about you, Winona?
This is Winona, and I feel that when we started this, it was an accident. but like when we continued it, our goal was to talk about what Jay just said, the human story, mm-hmm. especially with And I Thought I Did My Journey Alone. That book came about because we had been on tour for about half the year, for a few years. And as we sat down and we talked to people from different walks of life and everywhere, we recognized that they had some of the same problems. Most of them had the same questions. And we were just hearing these questions in different places, even around the world. So we were like, And I Thought I Did My Journey Alone is to tell you that you're not alone. Yes, it is hard. And yes, it feels like it's unique. Your problems are unique and special to you and only happen to you because you're in this walk of life. But there are so many people having the same problems.
Not to invalidate your problems.
Not to invalidate your problems. But so many people having the same problems, if we just listened, we could give each other such wonderful advice. To each other, we stop seeing everything else that everyone else says, oh, you should see this and that. No, you see a human being, sit down, talk to them, you will figure out that you guys have a lot of the same things going on, and we have to respect each other's opinions, values, and problems, and empathize, and then we can move forward. And that's what I'm hoping. It's a lot to ask for a book to do, nevertheless a poem to do, but that's what we're hoping that our poetry does.
Well, that's a wonderful place to end. Well, Nona Marie and JD, the And I Thought ladies, I want to thank you so much. This has just been wonderful. Your energy, your vision are truly inspiring. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Well, Nona Marie and J.D., the And I Thought ladies. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with Julia Zweig about her acclaimed book about the White House years of Lady Bird Johnson, Lady Bird Johnson Hiding in Plain Sight. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.